Welcome to We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
There. I did it the way I was supposed to.
Yeah.
And,
very good.
You can find everything you would like to know about our show at wethepeopleradio.us. And I really want to highlight the archives. They're extremely helpful. Anything we talk about on the show, publications that our guests have written, books that they've written, articles about them in the news, we always link all that stuff up on a page for each program, along with a commercial-free archive that our friend Robert Exter does for us. Thanks for that, Robert.
Yeah, thanks, Robert.
So he cuts out our salutes to capitalism, and that way it takes you less time to listen, which is great. So this is one of those programs that is a topic that we hear about a lot. And for some reason, it's usually discussed very briefly. And I think most people that it doesn't affect directly, I hate to say it, but maybe don't think about it at all. So today's going to be about anti-Semitism.
And I think unchecked, it will affect you directly.
Oh, most definitely will. Yeah. And our guest, Dr. Charles Asher Small, will explain that to you. But honestly, I think most people hear that and they think, well, I'm not Jewish. It doesn't matter. So today we will be explaining to you why it does matter. So just in case you thought Dr. Charles Asher Small was not qualified, let's see, his bio is 2.5 pages long. I'm not going to read you the whole thing, although it is posted, and it's impressive. He's the founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy. And it's abbreviated, obviously, or captioned as ISGAP. So the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy is ISGAP, and we'll be referring to that a lot today. So when you hear that, that's what we're talking about. I kind of cherry-picked through his resume things that I thought were, I mean, I actually was all really interesting. I started highlighting everything, and it's like, okay, that wasn't what I was.
We're going to have to do this in segments.
I wasn't really planning on highlighting all of it. So he was the founding director, and he convened groundbreaking academic seminar series, conferences, and programming in the emerging field of contemporary anti-Semitism studies at Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Stanford, Fordham, McGill, University of Miami, University in Rome, the Sorbonne in Paris, in France. He's everywhere. He's literally everywhere. And where was my list of all the places? Here we go. He's lectured throughout the world as an expert scholar on anti-Semitism, of course. He was a visiting professor at McGill, at Cape Town University, at La Sapienza in Rome, University of Lithuania. He's been a guest scholar and lectured in hundreds of universities around the world, addressed European Parliament, the United Nations, the Israeli Knesset, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. It just literally goes on and on, but my favorite part of his whole bio is just this little last sentence here of one paragraph. He says he's also served as a consultant and policy advisor in North America, Europe, South Africa, and the Middle East.
Was that all?
When they list your places by country.
Yeah.
It's so much faster, too. So anyway, really an interesting man. And I met him down at the Israeli consulate, and I had to go get on BART. So we were walking down the street and talking, and I thought, gosh, you know, there should be so many more people who heard just the little short, maybe 15-minute thing he presented. So we hatched a radio program on the streets of San Francisco, fearing for our lives, of course.
Yeah. And watching where you're walking.
Before the drug addicts came and the poop overtook us. He was trapped there for a period of time, but I believe he's back home now. Dr. Small, are you in there?
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Good morning, Dr. Good Small. Thanks for being on today.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here with you.
Are you still trapped in San Francisco, or did you get to escape and go back home?
No, I'm still in San Francisco.
Okay.
Yeah. Another 6 weeks or so.
Oh, I don't know. In my head, I thought you had said you got to go home in June, so I thought, I didn't ask him the beginning, the end, the middle. 6 weeks. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
You do, too. I don't know. It's not really a wild and woolly city. Were you the one they chased with hypodermic needles?
Yeah, that was one of my memorable experiences here.
Because I have another guy, he's with the National Parks Service, and he got transferred there and was so horrified, he actually relocated his family to Vancouver, Washington, and he's just going to commute.
Yeah.
Decided it was just better overall. Oh, my gosh. So We have, I mean, we've looked at so much of your information. I should tell people that if they go to charlesashersmall.com, spelled just like it sounds, there's a tremendous amount of information there. And also isgap.org, I-S-G-A-P, like Paul, .org. Huge amounts of information, and a lot of your lectures and papers are there for reference for people.
Also, too, I might add, I watched several of your seminars and lectures on YouTube. If you type in his name on YouTube, a whole bunch of stuff will come up, and you can actually sit and watch his talks.
You're actually one of those guys who can search on the internet and not a whole bunch of bad stuff comes up. So, good for you.
Yeah. Not yet. No kidding.
Well, you spend a tremendous amount of time working in the with academic people to try to educate them on what you call modern anti-Semitism. I don't know how you want to start this, but let's just presume people really haven't given this any thought and kind of go from that point.
Right. So one of the things that we do at ISGAP, so we're a nonprofit research center, and we're a 501c3 in the United States. And we're a nonprofit organization in Canada and Europe as well. And what we do, we start off by doing seminars and research on contemporary anti-Semitism. And what we started to do, we realized that there weren't any courses on the contemporary challenges of anti-Semitism. So we started actually, we developed a program at Oxford University where we bring professors, many from the United States, and we actually train them on how to create courses for credits at their home university. And there's really, I guess there's a blind spot on contemporary issues, because I think we've been taught, over the last generation or two, that anti-Semitism was something that was horrible that happened in the past,
yep,
that we somehow overcame it. And what we realize is that, you know, issues are reemerging in a powerful way, and we feel that anti-Semitism is not really a Jewish issue or an issue for Israelis, but it's an issue for anybody who cares about democracy and basic notions of citizenship. And as Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Peace Prize winner and survivor of the Holocaust, always taught, was that when, you know, that anti-Semitism begins with Jews, but it never ends with Jews. And I think that was one of his most important lessons, that once this form of hatred is unleashed on society, it knows no boundaries. And other groups and other peoples are attacked as well.
See, and that's, I think, the part that people don't, I'm not sure, you know, people really understand that or give that much thought.
Well, and also, I was listening to one of your lectures, and you spoke about I don't know if you were starting at the beginning or what, but there were basically three types of anti-Semitism, and now the basically a fourth emerging now with the contemporary anti-Semitism. But maybe you could briefly hit on those three types that I think people are somewhat familiar with.
Okay, sure. So, yeah, that's a good question. Thank you. So,
good job, Bill.
In my presentations and in my work, I basically argue there are three types of anti-Semitism, or anti-Semitisms with an S, plural. And what makes anti-Semitism unique is its inherent genocidal tendency. So other forms of discrimination or hatreds, racism, sexism, can cause a lot of damage, and it could be quite horrific. But there's something inherent in anti-Semitism that is genocidal, and I'll explain. So there's basically three phases of anti-Semitism. The first phase, or the dominant phase, when the dominant way of perceiving reality was through the lens of religion. At many points in time, not throughout in entire histories, but at many points in time, there was a Christian teaching that that the Jewish people didn't accept the Christian notion of the Messiah. So there was a belief that they were, quote-unquote, blinded by evil, and that they could not have personal redemption. So that's bad in and of itself. A group of people can't have personal redemption or be at one with God. But what made anti-Semitism sort of inherently genocidal is that people said that global redemption or world redemption would never happen until the quote-unquote stubborn Jews would accept the Christian notion of the Messiah. So this resulted in forced conversions, pogroms, groups of Jewish communities being exiled from various spaces over time. And then when the dominant view of the world shifted from religion to science and biology and basically notions of biologically determined groups like racial groups and ethnic groups, the Jews were perceived as being the wrong race and the wrong people. And in fact, people started saying things and circulating tropes and anti-Semitic tropes that Jews were destroying the purity of the white so-called Aryan race or the white nation.
Then it all goes down the drain. Hang on to that thought, Dr. Schmal. We'll be right back in 2 minutes.
What shall we do about them? When they move into your neighborhood, they take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
And we're back. You're listening to We the People. We are here with Dr. Charles Asher Schmal. He is the founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy, or ISGAP for short. Okay, go back to the big four.
Okay, so I was speaking about kind of Christian forms of discrimination over the centuries, mainly in Europe. And then I started to discuss the sort of when the dominant perspective of perceiving reality shifted from religion to science and biologically determined groups, the Jews were perceived mainly in Europe as being of a different so-called race. And we have to remember that the social sciences, the science, the theology at the time, people really believed in the innate differences of different characteristics that each so-called race had. And the Jews were perceived as an impure race, poisoning the purity of the white Aryan race. So unlike the time of Christianity, where Jews were at times offered the ability to convert or forcibly convert, people believed that race was somehow innate and you can't escape your so-called race or biologically determined group. So there was no escape for the Jews. And this type of racist anti-Semitism basically culminates in the Holocaust and the extermination of the Jewish people. Now, after the Holocaust, you can make the argument that there was, a honeymoon period. There was a time when sort of Nazi, fascist, and racist forms of anti-Semitism were no longer, thankfully, acceptable in the United States, in Europe. People sort of learned, in quotations, the lessons of the Holocaust. But what's happening today is sort of a new form of, or a contemporary form of anti-Semitism, which is focused on the demonization of who Jews are as a people. So the old forms of Christian anti-Semitism or racist anti-Semitism, if you were working in a good liberal institution at a good university or in the media of record, and you espoused those old types of anti-Semitisms, I think that you would be ostracized and perhaps your career could even come to an end if you articulated those unpopular beliefs and those damaging beliefs. But today, to demonize and to delegitimize who Jews are as a people, I would argue in those liberal, progressive institutions, you're not only not ostracized, but I think you're actually, you're promoted.
I think so, too. You see that all the time. Yeah. It's like, how are they getting away with all this stuff?
Exactly. So now the new anti-Semitism is the delegitimization and demonization of Israel as, if you look at the media, as a so-called apartheid state, which I think is a a travesty against the South African people who survived apartheid, that Israel is a racist state, a colonial state, a pinkwashing state. In other words, any epithet you can have against Israel is perfectly acceptable, and that's thanks to the sort of intellectual and political moment that we're living in this sort of postmodern, anti-Western, anti-American, anti-Israel moment. And I think that as Israel becomes, you know, every possible epithet is being used against Israel, many people thought that was just a problem for the Israelis. But we can see that those espousing those type of views are also attacking Jewish communities in Europe and now even in the United States. So if Israel is a racist, fascist, apartheid, colonial, pinkwashing, you name it, entity, well, then Jewish people going to pray on Sabbath or Jewish students going to, Jewish organizations at universities are now being perceived in a very negative light. So anti-Semitism is not just contained to Israel, but it's being exported around Europe and North America. And it's being exported by people on the radical, we call them the radical green or political Islamists. And I'm not speaking about Islam or Muslims, but I'm speaking about political Islam that cannot be allow anybody to be equal to a practicing Muslim. And the Jewish people through the State of Israel are the only non-Muslims in that part of the world who have self-determination. And it's a democracy. So Jews and Muslims and Christians, women, and other gendered identities, minorities, are all equal under the law in that democratic state of Israel. And you have Islamists who can't accept democracy, who want to destroy it on the one side. And on the other side, you have sort of the so-called, and I don't think they really are, but so-called liberal extremists who are also attacking Israel. And there's sort of a red-green alliance, the extreme left and the extreme green. And that's been operating at the intellectual level, the political level, for decades, and this is the sort of the spreading of contemporary anti-Semitism. And I think now we also have the emergence of the extreme right as well in Europe and in North America as well, which is beginning to also play a factor on the scene of anti-Semitism.
So how I don't know how to really word this, but in contemporary anti-Semitism, why is it that the Jewish people are always looped into almost the cornerstone of this new hatred, I guess you call it?
Yeah, why are always they're like the lightning rod for
hate.
Yeah,
and then, it just spreads out from there. Why is that?
So that's a great question. And the honest answer is, I really don't know, to be honest. I mean, you know, you can explain it from maybe a psychological perspective or an economic perspective or a political perspective. Maybe there's a metaphysical reason for it as well. I think it's like peeling an onion.
Right.
Sure.
Jews are sort of on the receiving end of sort of utopian movements that want to revolutionize and change the world. And it's interesting, but once again, you're right that the Jews are sort of, in this case, Israel's right in the middle. They're at the front line of a global war or a jihad against the West, and they're right in the middle of it, confronting it, I think, fighting for democratic, basic democratic values and values of decency and inclusion of all people.
Well, and it's,
they're fighting.
It's crazy because they're 1/19th the size of California. I mean, it isn't like they're controlling half the landmass on the earth.
Yeah.
I mean,
1/19th the size of California, and they're affecting global.
It's a little itty bitty place, and it's like, how hard would it be for all the people that surround them to just leave them alone?
Right.
I mean, it almost defies logic.
It's a profound question, and I think that's the question, and I think that's the challenge, actually, for Muslims in the region. And in a sense, I think Islam has a tradition of accepting the other and respecting the other. But I think Islam has been controlled now or hijacked by the Muslim Brotherhood and other offshoots of very radical, reactionary, narrow visions of what the world ought to be. And they can't accept the other. They can't accept women as being equal under the law. They can't accept Jews having self-determination on that space of land. And I think Israel, in a sense, poses a challenge to the Muslim community to live up to the best of its standards and to respect and to see the other, to accept the Jew as somebody equal to them. And it's a challenge for the geopolitical environment that we live in. And hopefully, you know, Muslims who are fighting for democracy and standing up to this brutal reactionary regime will get support from the West and usher in an era of more acceptance. But I think, in a sense, it's a challenge to them.
Because this is a whole new, if you think about it, just from a time standpoint, the first time it was on, the modern era radar was really, with Hitler and World War II and all that, and in Europe. Well, that generation of people is basically gone. So all of this is being carried out by a completely different generation of people who ostensibly should be a lot more educated. And oddly enough, if the Jewish population did the things or were the things, I guess if they really embodied all the things that these people ascribe to them, they would have imploded decades ago. You know? I mean, you can't be really bad and really all these things and be successful. And Israel has been extremely successful. And when you look at the fact that they're still there, huddled in among all these giant countries that hate them with lots of people in them, it's kind of a marvel.
Yeah, it is. It is. And what's interesting, too, you spoke about Nazi anti-Semitism. What's interesting is the Muslim Brotherhood, about 100 years ago, when they were created about 100 years ago in Egypt, and they actually take European anti-Semitism into the Middle East for the first time. And they actually take a lot of the political ideology and rhetoric of the Nazis into their core of their ideology. It's not the extreme wing or the military wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, but it's mainstream in their ideology. They basically took the notion of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a forged document, purporting to talk about how Jews are controlling the world and all these sort of horrific, anti-Semitic, irrational, kind of pathetic lies and tropes, which justified not only the removal of Jews from European society, but actually justified the extermination of them during the Holocaust. The Muslim Brotherhood and political Islam takes this as a mainstream part of their ideology.
And what is it called again?
The Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Yeah. It's funny, I was going to ask you about that because I forgot to bring my notes from that talk, and I thought, what was that called again?
Yeah. So it's a forged document that emerges in France or in Russia in the 1870s. And as Elie Wiesel said, and I think the most important thing about different forms of hatred is that the Holocaust did not begin with the crematoriums and the railroad tracks to the extermination camps. It began with words and ideas. And the words and ideas of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a forged document that purports to show how Jews were conspiring to take over the world.
Is that where the taking over the world thing comes from? Because
yes,
that's always a thread, and I'm thinking, from a numeric standpoint, you'd have to be kind of a dunce to believe that, but hang on one second. We'll be right back. Our guest is Charles Asher Small. We hope you will join us online at wethepeopleradio.us and send this program to friends who need the information. We'll be right back. So let's not leave this Protocols of the Elders of Zion, Dr. Small, because honestly, I'm willing to put money down that 90%, it's probably higher, of people have never heard of that and have no idea right. that there actually is a beginning to all this stuff. Was it a book, a pamphlet? What is it? And who wrote it?
Yes, so basically it's a forged document that emerges in France in the 1870s or 80s. Or Russia, depending, there's different historical understandings of where this emerged from. But it was this lie that actually, in the sort of the moment in Europe after emancipation and enlightenment and the emancipation of Jews, they became citizens of Europe for the first time in the late 1800s in Germany and in France. And there was sort of this backlash to the inclusion of Jews for the first time in Europe as citizens. And this lie kind of fed into this sort of, this sort of backlash against including Jews into European society. And it began to have traction. And as Elie Wiesel said, and I think it's very important, that the Holocaust, the extermination of European Jews, didn't begin with the railroad tracks and the crematoriums. It began with words and ideas. And the words of and ideas of the Protocols is now mainstream in many Middle Eastern countries, in Iran, in Egypt, in countries, in their music, in their culture, among their intellectuals. So the complete demonization of the Jewish people is mainstream. And those ideas that led to not only the extermination of 6 million Jews in Europe, but the decimation of Europe as a whole. The,
sure.
80 million people being killed, the entire infrastructure of Europe being decimated. That once this, as Elie Wiesel said, once this idea begins to gain traction, it begins with Jews, but it never ends with Jews. And you can look at Syria, you can look at Iraq, and you can see those reactionary movements are talking about the Jews and the Zionists and the Israelis. On the one hand, but just like the Nazis, on the other hand, they're killing their own brothers and sisters. They're destroying progressive democratic institutions in their society. And in the name of the concern about the Jew and the Israeli, they're killing their own people by large, large numbers. 15 million refugees from Syria, 1 million people being killed at the hands of Sunni and Shiite extremists who buy into this ideology of hatred.
And what's it? What is it? So it says that. Is it a long document? A short document? Is it a list? I mean, how did people get this?
It became popular among so-called intellectuals in Nazi Europe, Nazi
sure.
Germany, and the demonization of the other. The demonization of a so-called race that was impure, and the threat that this so-called group of people had to the mainstream of society became more and more acceptable at a time of economic and social pressures.
Okay.
And I think if anything, if we can learn from society, if we can learn from our history, is that we have to be very careful when we start demonizing groups of people, any groups of people. And this is not just a question of defending the groups of people's rights, but it's also, in my view, we have to see this as an attack on democratic principles. So once we start demonizing groups or subjugating groups or segregating groups or justifying all sorts of tropes and mysterious powers or innate characteristics and qualities of a group of people, it's an attack on who we are as a democracy.
I think that's a really important thing to point out, and it's also really important to underscore that came that it was promoted heavily through the intellectual elites. Because I mean, from the outside looking in, I obviously don't spend any time at any of the places that you do, but it seems like in our colleges and universities, especially in the United States, anti-Semitism seems to be alive and well.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. And it's fascinating. There's an assumption, or I grew up with an assumption that academics and intellectuals and professors and universities was a space to explore ideas, and it was an institution that defended and promoted democratic principles. But you're right. I think today in the United States and in other countries, universities have become the purveyors, the cutting-edge purveyors, and the justifiers of anti-Semitism and of reactionary anti-democratic politics. And it's extraordinary. And we can learn the lesson, actually, from Nazi Europe and Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, and that the university was the only institution in Germany, and this to me is remarkable, that the university was the only institution in Germany that voluntarily turned over its Jews and replaced them as professors. There's no other institution, the unions, the police, the army, never turned over voluntarily their fellow Jews. But the professors were quick to kick the Jews out of the university and take their jobs.
No kidding. So history does repeat itself a little bit there.
Yeah, so this tradition, yes, seems to be repeating itself. And I would argue that, you know, education is the cornerstone of a democratic society, and universities are perhaps the most important institution in our society because we train and we teach our future generation of leaders, you know, in all spheres of society, to coming up through the system, through the university, to enter into society. And it's there that I think Jewish students are experiencing anti-Semitism at much higher rates than other parts of society. So there's an age gap. Jewish Americans under 25 are experiencing anti-Semitism at much higher rates than older Jewish people in the United States. And there were studies that were done. Barry Cosman of Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, just did a study showing that Jewish students in the United States experience or have witnessed an anti-Semitic act in the last 6 months at much higher rates than women or female students experience sexism, and African Americans experience or witness racism. So the Jews experiencing hatred, experiencing it at almost four times the rate of other minorities or women.
And I know we're all shocked that we didn't hear any of this in the media.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And I think you're absolutely right. As far as the colleges, you know, the colleges used to be a place for, you know, free speech and ideas. But somehow we have thrown all that in the wastebasket. And now if you have an original thought or a thought that goes against
you're a blasphemer.
The grain, yeah, you can't do that at universities anymore.
Back in the day, since you've studied this extensively, did they have the demonizing and the silencing at that time like we're seeing it now? Was that also a characteristic? Because I'm assuming it's not new.
Right. No, I don't. I think it's changing, and it's changing rapidly. So, you know, I was a student in the 1980s and 90s, and you know, the extreme left and some extreme Islamists were kind of on the periphery of campuses, and there were some critical courses on Middle East politics and history and society that was there, but it was very much, I think, at the margins.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to do my doctorate degree, and I taught in England in the 1990s, and in Europe, these issues were much more advanced, and I mean, the anti-Semitism as part of education in Europe was much stronger than in North America, and it's almost like a wave that kind of swept over North America. I think it entered Canada in a big way, I'd say, about 15 to 20 years ago, and now we see it entering the United States in the last decade or so, and it's become a very powerful force. Not just on the university campuses where you have people like Students for Justice in Palestine and the Muslim Student Association, which are essentially funded and fronts for the Muslim Brotherhood in this country. So you have campus politics that are becoming kind of more contentious with these groups being more active and funded on our college campuses. So you have these sort of the extreme green, the radical Muslims on our campus, and you have the sort of progressive or the postmodern radical left in the classroom. So we're getting it from the radical left in the classroom, and we're getting it on campus from the Islamists. And there's sort of this red-green alliance that is there on university campuses, and it's making life difficult for Jewish American students to go to school.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, the campuses, I think, are in somewhat a reflection of our own government. I mean, we have this in our own, you know, we have people in our Congress that are
You try to do a resolution on anti-Semitism, and it turns into a pro-Muslim thing.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that work out?
It's
we've got to take a really quick break before we delve into that topic, but thank goodness we have tons of time, because Dr. Charles Usher-Schmall is our hostage for the whole show, so we get to pick his brain for a long time. I'm kind of excited about it. We will be right back.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We really appreciate it. Because, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, not long enough. This is way too, there's just too much stuff
to talk about.
You're listening to We the People. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Our guest, Dr. Charles Usher-Schmall. You're listening to We the People. We hope that you will send this program out to pretty much everybody you know. We're discussing contemporary anti-Semitism, and it's a topic I think we don't discuss much because most of us don't understand it well enough, really. We know that when we hear things, you hear some of this stuff like Bill had mentioned right before the break in our from some of the congressional representatives that have been elected by these extremists, and you hear the things they say, it's like, that is not, not going to fly.
It happened because of our, I think a lot of it comes from our colleges, and those people get the voting age, and then all of a sudden you start showing up in
the bad part is though, regular people listen to that and think, well, nobody's going to believe that. That's ridiculous.
Well, they are believing
But that's
it.
What happened before.
Yeah.
Nobody thought they would really do it, and they did.
Yeah.
So,
Dr. Small, I don't want to leave this subject, but I could you explain the difference between Zionists, Jews, and Israelis?
The whole Zion thing gets thrown around all the time, and it's good and bad, depending on who you hear it from. Yeah, smartness up there.
When you say the Zion thing, what do you mean? What do you mean?
Well, they throw this around all the time. You know, we're anti-Zionists, we're Zionists, and it's kind of like, I think people need to know, I don't know, let's just make it easy, who the good guys are and who the bad guys are.
Right.
Like, what does that mean in context?
So I think, so to me, and I think to most people, Zionism was a movement of the Jewish people, a Jewish liberation movement to take back our homeland. And, you know, everyone who reads the Old Testament or the Torah or the New Testament or even the Quran, if people read history and look at the region, everybody knows that the Jewish people's home is from that region. It's from Israel.
Right.
And after thousands of years of exile, of being treated as third and fourth class citizens in exile, and leading up to, I guess, the reaction to Jewish emancipation in Europe and to World War I and World War II, and the subjugation of the Jewish people in Europe and also in the Middle East and in Arab countries, the Jewish world said enough, and we had an opportunity to take back our homeland. And that's what Zionism is, the liberation of the Jewish land for the Jewish people and to have self-determination in our homeland. And our self-determination was reestablished in 1947, 1948, and that, to me, that's what it means to be a Zionist. And so as a Jewish person who prays three times a day facing Israel, facing Jerusalem, the fact that in my lifetime, after so many years of exile, that my people have self-determination in that part of the world, to me is miraculous, and it's a wonderful thing. It's the fulfillment of the Zionist movement. So that's Zionism, the liberation of the Jewish land.
Okay, so on the flip side, how did they paint this as I mean, it's such a, I don't know, I guess it sounds trivial to say, but it's such a small piece of land.
Right.
It's an important piece, I get that, but it's a relatively small area. Why the massive heartburn?
I think because it's a democracy in the middle of a region.
But besides that, where do they expect you to go? Is there an alternative?
Right.
You should have gone over here instead of over there. Is there any of, because I've never heard that.
Right. So I think it comes from the fact that radical Islam, not Islam and not Muslims, but political Islam, as a reactionary social movement, has taken strides and has received support and power throughout the region and in the West. But as a footnote, that's very important because I think the West has cooperated with the Muslim Brotherhood and radical Islamists for decades, and that's a whole other interesting issue.
Well, I mean, but care now is an integral part of our society and considered by a lot of people to be a legitimate organization,
right?
Which is crazy.
Yeah. So on the one hand, the radical, so political Islam can't accept the self-determination of anybody else other than a practicing Muslim on what they consider to be so-called Islamic land. So the Jews are the only people in that region to have self-determination who are not Muslim and have imposed democratic principles on their society. And political Islam is opposed to democracy. They're opposed to having any influence from the outside world, including the West, the United States, Europe, in their caliphate. And for them, it's unacceptable to have the Jewish people there. And I think as a result of oil and money and power, a lot of these sort of reactionary political Islamists have been influencing and paying money to universities, have been entering into all kinds of strategic alliances with Western countries. And in a sense, the Muslim Brotherhood has a long history of chapters. Actually, a lot of their exiled intellectuals from Egypt were at American universities where they helped to establish groups like the Muslim Student Society 70 years ago. And the Muslim Student Society and the Students for Justice in Palestine, funded in part by the Muslim Brotherhood, are, you know, carrying out on campuses their worldview. So that's happening. And then you can go back to European governments, Canadian governments, American administrations who have worked with these radical groups as well. And, you know, President Obama, for example, we know the Cairo speech was a very, I think, profound moment where he invited the Muslim Brotherhood to be honored guest of his Cairo speech, his first foreign speech outlining his foreign policy in Cairo. And that said a lot. That said a lot. So yeah. That gave a message to the Muslim Brotherhood. He also engaged, in quotations, the Iranian revolutionary regime. And these are all movements that want to exterminate the Jews. They see Jews as animals. They want to subjugate women. They want to subjugate religious minorities, and yet Western governments work with them. Oxford University's Islamic Society, Islamic Studies Center at Oxford University, one of the most prestigious universities in the world, started none other than Yosef Kaladawi, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood. So you have the British establishment and even the American establishment working with these anti-democratic, anti-American, anti-Semitic movements.
Are there any Muslim organizations that you're aware of that are accepting of the Jewish nation and the Jewish people?
Anybody who has any horsepower?
Yeah, so there definitely are. I think there are Muslims in this country and mosques in this country and in Western countries and in the Middle East and other parts of the world that try to reach out to the other, that try to reach out to the Jewish community, to other communities, to try to instill democratic principles in their congregants, to understand that living in a democratic country, you're entitled to religious freedom and you're entitled to go to your place of worship and worship as you wish, but that we are participating in a society with that every citizen has rights, that every citizen has the right to be equal under one law, and that there's certain ideas and practices that are not compatible to radical Islam in the United States or in other Western democracies. So I think there are. We work with groups in Europe like the Quilliam Foundation. These are Muslim intellectuals who are fighting fiercely for democratic principles and fighting against anti-Semitism and the demonization of Jews and others. So there's some great people and great movements doing work in this field, and they should be supported and helped and, I think, sought out and worked with.
I would imagine that groups like that in the Middle East are probably in some sort of danger.
Few and far between?
By voicing their accepting of Israel. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. I think
they're not popular. They're not the cool kids.
Right. I think they're really brave, and there are people working to the acceptance of Israel. And I think that there's some shifts in the region, too, which are really interesting. I think as Iran, or the Iranian revolutionary regime of Iran, threatens not only Israel, but its other neighbors in the region, that there's sort of this organic, I'd say, possibility of an alliance emerging with Israel and Sunni nations who are worried about the expansive and brutal nature of the Iranian revolutionary regime.
That's so kind of nice. It's a little bright spot.
Pardon me?
It's a little bright spot on the horizon.
There is, yes. There's more cooperation at that level, and hopefully that it can be a long-term phenomenon.
Do you take much pushback at Oxford, since they do have this heavy presence of Muslim Brotherhood there?
So it's an interesting story. I can tell you, the story quickly, but I did my PhD at Oxford.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to walk you into the corner and then leave you standing there alone.
Okay, no problem.
We're going to get cut off by the news here shortly, but when we come back, I do want to hear that, because I am curious how this happens on a college campus, because what happens on a college campus also happens in society. I mean, how do you share the space?
Yeah.
You know, the Muslim Brotherhood, and you guys are having a seminar about how those guys are oppressing everyone and being anti-Semites. I'm dying to know. We will be right back with our guest, Dr. Charles Asher Small. He is the founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy. You can find him at isgap.org. There's to have it right there. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Welcome to We the People Radio. This is the second half of a two-hour program with our guest, Dr. Charles Asher Small. And if you missed the first half, you can find that at wethepeopleradio.us. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And, we're here most every week trying to bring you things that are educational, things that you wouldn't hear else in other places, and things that get relegated to
a soundbite.
Let's see. I saw Dr. Small on a Fox News channel in some other town, San Diego, I think it was, after the shooting, and I think it was a 5-minute clip, which was actually kind of a lot of time. But when I heard him down at the Israeli consulate, he did about a 15, maybe 20-minute presentation, and I thought, okay, that was way too short. way too short. So he is the founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy, ISGAP for short. ISGAP.org is the web location for that, or you can look up charlesashersmall.com. And just to cut to the really, I just thought it was the fun part of his bio, he has served as a consultant and a policy advisor in North America, Europe, South Africa, and the Middle East. So pretty much, he's running the world. We're just going to shorten it to that. Charles Asher Small, and he's running the world. And there's we'll get into, I'll make a note. I'll make a note about the Russia thing. Let's not muddy the water. Okay, so we had a story on the table with you, Dr. Small. I was asking about how you have all these Islamic studies things at Oxford that are kind of, you know, big. And then there you are discussing anti-Semitism and how a lot of these guys are promoting things that are anti-Semitic. How do you split up the campus? You guys have a fence down the middle, or you wear colors like the Crips and the Bloods?
Almost. It's getting to that. So basically at Oxford, I did my doctorate there, and I have some friends that I stay in contact with. And essentially, so Oxford and England at this moment is actually, it's going through a very difficult time. I would say it's almost become a cesspool of hatred and recrimination and anti-Semitism, particularly at the universities and certainly within the government. I think Jeremy Corbyn is a walking poster child for some of the problems that we're facing in Western democratic countries, including the United States, where you have sort of a left-wing politician who's in bed and is being paid and sponsored by the Iranian Revolutionary Regime. He worked for them, funding and friends from the Muslim Brotherhood. So you have, on the extreme left, this very strong relationship that goes back decades to the Muslim Brotherhood, and you have somebody like Yosef Kawadawi, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, who starts Islamic studies at Oxford University. And this is a man who calls for all believers to finish the work of Hitler.
Yikes.
And this is a man, yes, this is, and he didn't wake up in the morning and had a bad day to say this. This is a part of a central element of the Muslim Brotherhood's ideology. They amalgamate a very narrow vision of Islam with European fascism and Nazism. And this is who they allow to create Islamic studies at Oxford. And
wow.
To make a long story short, some friends of mine who were professors, and now they run the international studies program at Oxford, were interested in our proposal. We were actually trying to get it into our program into an Ivy League university in the United States, and the opposition was so difficult, we were having a hard time finding a home for it in the U.S. So my friends asked to see the proposal, and they liked it, and they accepted it at Oxford. And sure enough, within about 2 weeks of the program being accepted, professors from Middle East Studies and other kind of Islamists and leftists started to protest against the administration for allowing a Jewish Zionist project into the university. So there was a lot of opposition, and actually friends of mine threatened to resign in the name of academic freedom and freedom of speech if the university was going to shut the program down, because it was a serious academic program. We have professors from, you know, top universities from all over the world teaching professors, so it was a serious program. And my friends who are liberals, who are not Jewish, really stood up for democratic freedom. And they prevailed. And when they accepted the program under this sort of fraught moment in the politics of Oxford, I invited every administrator or professor from Oxford to sit in on our program and to, you know, they would see that we were doing something that was of high levels of scholarship. And they came in and they, you know, they passed by and they realized it was a serious seminar. So that was 5 years ago. And in the past 5 years, with the increased threat of anti-Semitism to the democracy in England, and with Brexit and the rise of sort of anti-democratic politics, we are getting more and more support, because we frame our program within the framework of protecting democratic principles and human rights. So we have more friends and supporters in Oxford these days, and I think more and more people realize in Europe that anti-Semitism is a threat to the way of life of the democracies in Europe. And there's, I think, a robust defense of democratic principles and also the fight against hatred against Jews and other minorities emerging in Europe. And it's time that these issues also, I think, become front and center in the United States, because we have some of these the so-called extreme left and the radical Muslim alliance is now affecting politics in this country. And I think we need to become, as a society, very much aware of what's at stake, not just to the Jewish community, because that's the distraction. The anti-Semites want you to look at the Jews and the Israelis and the Zionists, and while your gaze is at the Jew, these people are affecting your universities and now Congress and our policies. And we need to become fluent in the ideology of political Islam and why the extreme left is in bed with the Islamists and their push to change society here.
You spend a lot of time studying this. We've done the concept of political Islam, for anyone who listens to our program, is not a new idea. We have done dozens of shows on this topic. So that part isn't a comprehension stretch for anybody. But I guess what is a big stretch for most people is why would... And maybe this is one of those, you know, rhetorical who the heck knows questions, but why does the extreme left, who supposedly wants special rights for everyone, feel that it's okay to demonize one group of people? Do you see any is there any trend showing up?
It sounds like the whole Zionist idea is where they have the problem. Is that it, or is just a part of it, or what?
So I think, look, anti-Semitism runs deep into our culture in the West. And here you have sort of this reactionary social movement, meaning the political Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, and the Iranian Revolutionary Regime, the Shiite world, sort of emerging with this... very narrow interpretation of Islam, interwoven with European notions of anti-Semitism and of Nazism, and it's powerful. And then on the left, you have this sort of intellectual moment. You have postmodernity and the left intellectuals of Edward Said and Michel Foucault and sort of postmodernism, where notions of good and evil are thrown out the window. All narratives are equal and need to be represented. So you have this sort of anti-Western, anti-Zionist, anti-neo-imperialism, left-wing ideology that also has something in common with the extreme Muslims. The extreme Muslims want to destroy the state as a vestige of European colonialism. They want to rid the so-called Islamic world of Jews, of Christians, of capitalism, of socialism, anything Western. And you have these kind of, I don't know, left-wing, progressive, I think that's a misnomer, but people who identify as that, who are against American hegemony and American intervention and Western intervention in the world, and they want to join the Palestinian cause to rid the Zionists of the region. And it's a horrifically... I don't even have the words, but there's a hypocrisy that's so deep. And when people act irrationally and with such profound hypocrisy, it's I think one of the issues clearly affecting this behavior is a deep-seated anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, not able to accept the self-determination of the Jewish people in their homeland. And it's ugly, and that actually makes sense.
How about this? We need to take a really quick break, and when we come back, I'd really like to let's continue on this Palestinian issue, because that is always at the core of it, and I think it's fundamentally misunderstood as well. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Guest Dr. Charles Asher Small, the founding executive director for the Institute and Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy. And you can find more information about that at isgap.org. Okay, so now we've kind of gone into the liberal mania and the Palestinian thing, and that just seems to be their coalescing point, that the Jews are, you know, being mean to the Palestinians, so now suddenly defending the Palestinians is the cause of choice, I guess. And that seems to be fueling a lot of the anti-Semitism, just from what it looks like out here in the cheap
seats.
Well,
I think that's one of the doors they used to open up this whole thing and shed, you know, a bad light on Israel, which
right.
I don't think is fair.
So if you were going to defend that or fix it or explain it, maybe, I don't know if explaining it's possible, but when you see all of that, what, and you, if you could sit them all down and give them a talk, what would you tell them?
Right. So it's a very complicated, complex issue, but I would say at one level, it is kind of simple. The Palestinian National Liberation Movement was taken over or kind of emerged actually out of the Muslim Brotherhood. So this is a reactionary social movement that perceives Jews as subhuman, as emanating from apes and pigs and from the urine of donkeys. This is literally from their, among, you know, from their intellectuals. This is the garbage that they espouse. And I think once you have a social movement that dehumanizes human beings, that doesn't see that every person or every human being created in the image of God, and there's something sacred about every life of every individual, when you debase somebody to the point that they become, the imagery is that they're not human and they're kind of animal-like, it's a very difficult and dangerous ideology. So here you have a social movement that doesn't see their opposition as fully human. And they can't recognize the other. So at one level, I think we in the West, we want equality, we want the underdog to be respected and taken care of. And, you know, I think Palestinians deserve some form of self-determination. They deserve, you know, good, peaceful lives, as does everybody else. But their liberation movement has been hijacked by this movement that wants to literally calls for the extermination of another group. So it's a very difficult process. And then people who don't understand the ideology and the mission of this movement, I think well-meaning people on the left in the West, and or well-meaning people not just from the left but from Western countries, are rooting for the underdog. And they want some sort of just solution. But I think what I would urge people to do is to really understand the ideology and the objective of this movement. And it's one of destroying democracy and liquidating the Jewish people, not even just the state of Israel, but the Jewish people, sort of using this Nazi ideology and imagery.
Yeah, and it's hard to sit down at a bargaining table when you know that's their platform to start with. How do you negotiate from that point? It seems impossible.
Yeah, so I would say you cannot. There's a very important philosopher named Emmanuel Levinas, and Levinas was born in Lithuania. He was a student in France. He was doing philosophy in France, and his entire family was exterminated and brutally murdered in the Holocaust in Lithuania. And because he was a student in France, he managed to survive. And he went on to become one of the 20th century's greatest philosophers. And he was a philosopher dealing with ethics. And he said two profound things for me when I read him and studied him. He said that the moment we see our face in the face of the other, that's the instant we become human. So the minute we see our face in the face of the other, that's the moment we're human. And we need the other, in a sense, to become human. We have to be ethical to the other. And this is the cornerstone for any civilized society. However, he also goes on to say that if a social movement or a political ideology dehumanizes people, dehumanizes people as the cause of disease, as the cause of all the problems in the world, or gives them animal-like characteristics. He also argued that that's an ideology that must be completely destroyed, destroyed intellectually and destroyed militarily, destroyed. Because you can't negotiate with a movement and with people who think they're dealing with others who are not human. So this is a profound challenge. So I don't think you can negotiate with people who are sitting down with the other who don't see them as human.
No.
And this ideology is espousing that clearly. This is, and I think if you go online to read the Hamas Charter, if you go online to read the founding fathers of the Muslim Brotherhood, like Qutb and al-Banai, it's there. It's there in black and white.
Right. And that being said, is I think people can understand why there are no talks going on. I mean, you can't
every time you do it, all of a sudden they're lobbing bombs.
Yeah. You can't sit across the table from somebody that has that ideology or those ill thoughts towards you to start with. I mean, that has to be neutralized before any talks can even begin. So I think that's the uphill struggle, and it's been that way for forever over there, hasn't it?
It's been like that for a long time. That's true. I said, but I think it's also important to point out that the G7, the United States, the five countries that negotiated this deal with Iran, transferred billions of dollars of cash and trade deals and all sorts of things to get them to sign this deal over their so-called nuclear weapons program. And here you have money that was sent by the United States and sent by European countries that has been used in death squads by roaming militias in parts of Iraq and Syria, killing, hundreds of thousands of people. So our money being used in a war is being waged by people who have this ideology. And we naively, I think, believe that, if we give them money, if we bring them into the family of nations, they're going to change their ideology and they're going to become more peaceful or more Western or the like. And this results in catastrophes.
No,
clearly.
That's why I think the whole premise of a two-nation solution, it can't work if one side has those beliefs. You're basically just going to give them a launching pad to continue their bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree. If I could wave a magic wand, I would like to have a two-state solution where both the Israelis and the Palestinians were good neighbors living side by side in a peaceful arrangement in a peaceful region. It would be wonderful. And
sure.
I think that the resources and the ingenuity, and it could become an amazing part of the world that could contribute much. But I unfortunately agree. You can't negotiate with people who want to exterminate you. There's no negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully one day the Palestinians will have a responsible leadership that will really be intent on a rapprochement and recognizing Israel and the Jewish people's rights in their homeland, and I'm certain the Israelis would reciprocate, and they would ought to reciprocate if that was the situation.
So, with that, getting back to the United States, what do you see as a first good step in solving this situation with Palestine? Is there something we're doing that we shouldn't be doing, or something we should be doing that we're not?
So it's a great question. I think what we should be doing is becoming more aware of the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood and the sort of red-green alliance, and then I think also the reaction to it that's also emerging. I think as a society, I believe it was Jefferson who said that the greatest threat to democracy was the ignorance of the citizens. And today there's a threat against our democratic country coming from the extreme green, the Muslim Brotherhood and its proponents, and this sort of acquiescence by our intellectuals and our human rights community to this threat. And we see with Congresswoman Omar entering Congress and espousing the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood. And we are not fluent in the minds of our enemy. We don't know what she was saying. And she said horrific things about the United States. She said horrific things about the Jewish people based on Muslim Brotherhood ideology. And we in the Democratic Party and we in the Jewish community, we excused her with a sort of, I would say, a paternalistic liberal form of racism. You know, she doesn't know what she's saying, or she didn't.
She didn't mean it that way. Right. I love that one. That's my favorite.
But here is a woman. She is an immigrant. She came to this country, and in a very short period of time, gets educated and becomes a leader of her community. She makes it to Congress. And she's a smart, intelligent, capable American citizen, and all the power to her. But to say that she's ignorant and stupid and she doesn't mean what she says is astounding. And that's unethical. She knows what she's saying. She's espousing an ideology. And the fact that she could, like a hot knife going through butter, divide the Democratic Party and the Jewish community in a couple of weeks shows how ignorant we are to this threat. And I think we need to understand where she's coming from and what kind of support she's getting and from who, like CARE, which is also a front for the Muslim Brotherhood, and how she's supporting the demonization, not just of Israel, but Jewish American citizens and anybody who supports the Jewish community in this country. So it's dangerous.
It's very dangerous.
Yeah.
We're going to come back here in a couple of minutes with our guest, Dr. Charles Asher Small, and I want to talk a little bit about how this plays out in the long run for a democratic form of government, because you had talked about that in the meeting I sat in previous, and it was a scary idea. We will be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, we were talking about Congressman Omar and the hate speech that she spews almost daily and gets away with, and how the left doesn't say anything to her. And I think that really illustrates how effective that type of speech is, and how easily it is to sway. Like you said, half of Congress is maybe not going along with it, but they are going along with it.
They're not
saying anything, and that's going along with it. I think that's something that we really need to address in our highest house of government, how we can let that continue.
No, I agree very much with you, and I think we need to become more literate and more understanding of the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood and their tactics, because they can demonize the Jews, and many of us, if we're following the political debates of the day, a lot of us will dismiss that as perhaps she has some sort of problem, or it's a problem for the Jewish community, and you know, some of us agree or disagree. But what's interesting is that the anti-Semitism is always a distraction for anti-democratic forces. They focus on the Jew, while it's like the puppeteer. You look over there, you look at the Jew, you look at the anti-Semitic tropes about the Jew, you look at the anti-Semitic tropes about the Zionist or the Israeli, and you're focusing on the victim of this hatred. But while your gaze is over there, on the other side, just like the Nazis and just like what the Muslim Brotherhood does throughout the Middle East, they change in the most brutal way institutions and society, and they're anti-democratic, they're sexist, they're anti-Semitic, they're anti-minority, and they want Islam in a very narrow form of Islam to be the dominant and only acceptable view of a diverse, great religion. And when we give these people a pass in the Democratic Party, when we give these people a pass at the university, we're setting ourselves up for a catastrophe. And you can look at the Middle East, it's on fire. There's millions of people being killed. There's millions of refugees. The migration crisis through Turkey entering into Europe, there's a backlash against this crisis. I think there's an awakening of nationalism and even racism and white supremacy as a reaction to the silence of the human rights community and the intellectual community, which has been perhaps bought and sold in part by this very dangerous ideology. So this is a threat to democracy. And I'll just say, a couple of weeks ago, there was a 24-hour period where I think this sort of culminated. You had the New York Times cartoon depicting Netanyahu having Donald Trump on a leash, and he was blind in this anti-Semitic cartoon, and that Netanyahu was leading the blind Trump into war. 12 hours before that, you had Zarif, the head of the foreign minister of the Iranian Revolutionary Regime, saying that the Jews are tricking Trump, President Trump, into a war in the Middle East against Iran. So you have the New York Times and radical extremists in Iran with the same message. And then just hours after that, you have an attack by the gunmen in San Diego. So you have extreme white nationalists, liberal New York Times, and the foreign minister of Iran, all espousing the same anti-Semitic trope, and its roots are the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Its roots are the same in European anti-Semitism and fascism. And here it is, alive and well, in our global discourse today.
Yeah, it's frightening, and it's going unchecked. That's what just blows
my mind. It is going unchecked because we're not allowed to talk about transgender. We're not allowed to talk about LGBT. We're not allowed to, you know, all those things. If you bring up any of those things, you're bad.
Oh yeah, and you're destroyed.
Anything about black on black crime? Oh, you're a racist. You can't talk about that. All these things you can't speak about, but this is just hangs in the air.
And it's just allowed to go on.
You had made a really excellent point, and I know this will run us into another break, but we can't finish the show without discussing it. You had made a point that just will stick with me forever. A couple of months ago, when you were kind of giving us that brief overview, and you had said that every time that this happens, your system of government ultimately falls. And I thought, holy crap, you're right. I mean, what's the logical conclusion? And what do people like Omar and that other stupid woman. I know there's so many, right?
Yeah.
The other one who escapes me at the
Talib.
Moment. Yeah. That one. So, I mean, what they basically want is socialism. Same too with Ocasio-Cortez, but that's what they're after, is socialism. So, is this the precursor? You know, we usher in radical anti-Semitism, we glorify the ideas of the Muslim Brotherhood, and then we flip over our source of our form of government?
Right, yeah. So, should I respond or wait?
No, go ahead. I'm done ranting, sorry.
So I think it's a serious threat when the Muslim Brotherhood is basically, we call it an anti-systemic movement. It's an anti-modernizing movement. It's anti-modernization. It's anti-enlightenment. It's anti-democratic. And that's, you know, at one level, you could sort of understand it and why it emerges and why it's gaining strength in certain parts of the world. But the amazing thing and the intriguing thing is, why would progressive people, in quotations, support a movement that's anti-democratic, it's anti-American, it's anti-Western, it's anti-equality? So here you have people on the left, intellectuals on the left, and politicians who claim to be on the left, who are supporting the agenda of Omar or the Muslim Brotherhood, like President Obama was supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood. He goes to Cairo. The State Department helped him organize in the elections several years ago. They enter into negotiations and exchanges with the Iranian Revolutionary Regime. So how do people who are progressive and liberal also get into bed and have an alliance with an anti-systemic, anti-democracy, anti-capitalist, anti-American, anti-European movement? And this, to me, this contradiction is very dangerous and profound. And why is the left silent when Omar represents a movement that's not just anti-Semitic, that's disturbing in and of itself, but this is a movement that wants to subjugate women.
Right.
According to the Muslim Brotherhood, adult women cannot go out into public spaces unaccompanied by a male member of their family. So here you have progressive women in the universities, you know, professors and human rights activists and leaders of industry who are sympathetic to Congresswoman Omar. But these are women who would stand up fiercely, I'm sure, if you would ask them, should a woman be equal under one legal system in a democracy? I'm sure they would say yes. And yet, they're supporting a sexist agenda. You know, these are people that also believe that gay people should be killed.
Right.
These are the type of people that...
It's not a rights issue, it's a life issue.
Exactly. It's you know, in democracies, we believe in the notion that every citizen must be equal under one law. The Muslim Brotherhood does not believe that. They don't believe in the idea of citizenship. They don't believe in the idea that everybody's equal under one law. There's certain laws for practicing Muslims. There's certain laws for practicing male Muslims. There's certain laws for women. And there's lesser laws for the dhimmi, the protected religious minorities like Christians and like Jews, who are not full citizens under their vision of the caliphate and of society.
Now we get to convert or pay the tax or die.
Exactly.
Those are the choices.
How can progressive people be... How can we consider that? It's beyond.
I keep thinking it's got to be that same mental disconnect. I mean, really, it's if we could get a little psychiatry update.
Pick and choose, you know, the ideas they like.
But I think they think it's just like socialism. The reason socialism hasn't worked in other parts of the country or other parts of the world is that they did it wrong. We're going to do it different, and it'll be better here. So maybe if the Muslim Brotherhood's primary tenants take over, it's going to be different here.
Right.
Which is really just crazy.
Right. If we're nice to them, maybe they're going to become like us.
And that's worked out really well.
Right. And we don't have to understand their worldview. We don't have to respect their worldview. We don't have to understand that it's rooted in a deep worldview that includes religion and philosophy and politics and military strategies. These are intelligent people. But we don't have to study it. We don't have to learn about it. We don't have to understand their language and their mission and their ideology, because if we treat them well, they're going to be like us. If we treat them bad, they're going to be at war with us.
Well, that was President Obama's whole thing, was if we just went around the world, apologized to everybody, and we were super, super nice.
They'd all come
everything
to the table
would
and everybody
be better.
Would, yeah,
and Trump's a big monster because he threatened to put tariffs on Mexico. But, that actually worked, which is causing them all sorts of problems. That blows the whole paradigm. We've got to take a really quick break again. Darn it. Love capitalism, but it's so intrusive. Shoot. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Charles Asher Small. We are We the People Radio. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back. Sort of glossed over the how does this all turn out in the end if left unchecked?
Yeah, how has it happened in the past?
So if you could put on your, you know, if this was a Swami session, you know, and you're the guy wearing the Swami hat, what does the future look like if this goes without any pushback?
So, you know, I can't look into the future.
Oh, come on. That's what we told everybody you did. you're running the whole world. We already know this.
Right. I forgot.
Every continent, except Russia.
So what I would say is you can look to Europe. And if you look to France and Belgium and the United Kingdom and other countries, you have, I say, an influx of migrants, many of which harbor anti-democratic and anti-Semitic ideas and beliefs and a worldview, and they are not being integrated effectively into society. So you have parts of Paris and Brussels and now London that are very difficult spaces for Jews to enter, for women to enter, for couples to walk in ways that we're accustomed to, because these are areas in which people are trying to implement formally and informally a way of life that is antithetical to democratic societies and to cities where democracy was actually born. And I think that this is dangerous and is causing a backlash against migrants and immigrants, which is unfortunate as well. So there's, if you look to Hungary and Greece and Romania, and also to France, I think we also, because of the human rights community silence on this reactionary social movement, now there's also a reaction starting, I think, of extreme nationalism and even racism in Europe and also in North America. So there's an attack on our democratic principles from the extreme right and white nationalism, from Islamists, and from the extreme left. So the center is under attack. And I think those who believe in democratic principles, we have to understand why this is happening and to find ways to safeguard it and to give our citizens a good education in democratic principles and civic ideas and democratic principles.
Yeah, because in you know, history shows that once this process starts, if it goes unchecked, your society is doomed. It will eventually fall into chaos and war.
Well, in the first hour, you brought up a really good point that it didn't just destroy the Jewish population, which it did by the millions, but it also physically destroyed giant swaths of Europe and killed zillions of people. I don't even know how many people were killed, but we just
saw millions.
Just recognized D-Day, and obviously those images should be fresh in everyone's mind, and that all started with ideas.
Exactly. And I think you could look to the Middle East, where these horrible ideas have gained traction over the last decades. Old fascist Nazi forms of anti-Semitism and of ideas of governance. And you could look to the region, and it's imploded, and there's horrific carnage and destruction in the name of creating some sort of utopian religious society. You know, they talk about the Jews and Israel and Zionism, and it's very anti-Semitic, but they're killing their own Muslim brothers and sisters. So it's dangerous, and this implosion of civility and of governance is now, you know, it's at the doorstep of Europe, and it's a great challenge for European democracy, and it's also going to be a challenge for democratic countries in the Western Hemisphere, including the United States.
Oh, it's knocking on the door here, and I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of people that want to take a run at it. They want to let it, give it a try, give it a test drive, see how it's going to work out. And once you start down that road, bad things are going to happen. And I think every time in the past, I mean, how has it turned out? How has it turned out when
bloodbath?
Yeah,
basically.
Sure.
So when joke about it, but I don't know that many people who have consulted and helped with policy in, you know, North America. That's a big place. Europe, large place. South Africa, and the Middle East. I mean, that's quite a swath of the world that you have had the ability to consult with and influence. The one place I see that is very much missing is the Russia and that whole area. Russia, China. Is there any interest there at all? And I see one of your colleagues is doing some speaking regarding Russia here this month, I think.
Yeah. So that we touch on issues in Eastern Europe, Ukraine, and Russia in our summer school at Oxford. But it really hasn't been the focus of our research for various reasons. I think the urgent area was the Middle East and radical Islam and its acquiescence on the left. But these issues are also very important. We have a colleague named Sam Sokol, we're doing a book launch for his book on Thursday in our center in New York City, and he just wrote a book about Putin's war against the Jews and looking at the politics of Russia and Ukraine. And he's a scholar and a journalist with a lot of experience sort of there on the ground in the war. And he's looking at propaganda, Russian propaganda and Ukrainian propaganda, and how the Jews are being used by both sides. So it's a fascinating book. Hmm. Or the image of the Jew
sure.
is being used.
Well, we had somebody called in to bring up that the United States is a representative republic and not a democracy, which, of course, we know. We were talking about the idea of democratic forms of government around the world, really, kind of as a whole big basket, because not all of those are representative republics.
Correct.
And that idea of freedom of speech and those types of things, not the representative form of government, but the form it takes all over the world where you get to debate ideas and all that. That all blows up when this anti-Semitism takes hold. And, you know, Dr. Small, what's your thought on, you know, you push people to the wall. You know, you let in all these immigrants who have no intention of assimilating. They come with all these radical ideas. That does, on the other side, create some nationalism just because people feel like their country's, you know, sliding away.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that can be avoided, I guess, if we just started bringing in immigrants the right way? Because
right.
It seems like an easy fix.
So I think immigration is a key strength to American society and Canadian society and many other societies. Immigration is a wonderful thing, but it needs to be governed well. And also, having said that, I think, you know, there's international law when it comes to refugees, that people have a legitimate, according to international law, a legitimate claim they have a legitimate process to claim refugee status. There should be a fair and speedy hearing. And if they are true bona fide refugees, they have a right to enter the country where they initially land as a refugee, and if they're deemed not to be refugees, then they're deported, and it should be in orderly fashion, and people should have the right to this process. But having said that, I also think that a failed foreign policy on these issues also plays a role. So, for example, I remember the red lines during the Obama administration in Syria, and I think many refugees and immigrants don't want to leave their homeland. So there was a threat. There was a model that was being floated that there should be a safe zone within Syria. For displaced people, they would be protected by Western countries. It'd be a no-fly zone, and refugees can sort of wait
right.
in a corner of Syria and be helped by the international community and then repatriated in their villages and cities when the war was over.
Yeah.
But of course, that didn't happen. So I think we need to have strong...
It didn't even happen support. A little. I mean, that wasn't even like it... It wasn't even like it failed. It just never...
Never materialized.
It just never showed up.
And then you have Erdogan in Turkey, who's now, you know, very much engaged in the Muslim Brotherhood and maybe even the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, kind of turning on and off the flow of refugees entering into Europe as he tries to, swindle Europe out of resources and power, kind of turning the tap on and turning the tap off of refugees. So it's a mess.
It is a mess. And when you wind up with unchecked immigration, you look at the mess it created in Germany. You look at the mess in, just to pick specific cities, Paris and London. They've got some serious problems. I don't know how they solve that. I mean, London has had some no-go zones for, gosh, I remember we talked to a guy in London 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And they already had carved out parts of the city that even the police didn't get to go in.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you speak about that, you get into trouble as well.
That's why he comes on using a fake name.
Yeah.
I mean, which is pretty darn bad that you're not even allowed to say, hey, you know what, this isn't really working out.
And
that's also part of the problem.
Yeah. I think we should remember that the vast majority of immigrants and refugees are grateful for having the opportunity to have a second chance at life and to live in these countries. Most are hardworking people, but yeah,
But it's pretty easy
really
to exploit. Yeah, when you see that wide open door, it's pretty easy to exploit for nefarious purposes.
No, definitely. And
we've made it as easy as possible. Hopefully that changes soon. All right. So we have run out of time, as I knew we would, darn it. Our guest today has been Dr. Charles Asher Small. We thank you so much for coming on with us and for educating us on all these really, really important topics.
Thank you. It was a big honor to be with you for 2 hours and to be your guest. So thank
it takes
you.
2 hours, for heaven's sakes. This is a big, big topic. So we hope folks will send this to their friends and family. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.